Ho ho ho, friends! I'm Zen Hess, and you are listening to Currents in Religion, a podcast brought to you by the Department of Religion at Baylor University and by Baylor University Press. Thanks for joining us today. This is a special Christmas episode. In it, you'll hear from three church historians who discuss the origins of Christmas, the legend of Old Saint Nick, the development of Christmas carols, and the way Christmas has been received or rejected in global contexts. In other words, it's a podcast about Christmas throughout history and around the world. Keep listening if you want to learn something about Christmas and get a few nerdy conversation starters for Christmas dinner. And personally, I think this episode would make a great gift to someone special in your life. So make sure you share it with someone who you think might enjoy it. Our first guest is David Wilhite, a friend of the religion department and professor of Christian theology at Truett Seminary. He is author and co-author of numerous books and essays, including the forthcoming Cambridge History of Ancient Christianity with Bruce Longenecker. He's here to tell us a bit of the story of how Christians began celebrating Christmas and the legend of Saint Nicholas. David, what's the story behind celebrating Christmas?
So the earliest records have the Christians celebrating Easter, Jesus' resurrection, but almost no mention in the first two centuries of anything like Christmas. And so it's a common idea that Christians just borrowed this from the Roman pagan festival known as Saturnalia. Okay. That took place every December, the middle of December, where slaves got to act like masters. Everyone gave gifts to each other. It's a festival of Saturn. And so the kind of common thought is Christians must have just borrowed this. Uh-huh. And it doesn't quite work just because the dating is off. I mean, first off, Christians decide on December 25th, not December 17th. They are actually talking about this date even before Romans are trying to pinpoint a date, like tying this to something like Sol Invictus, who was another Roman god, a deity of the sun, whose birth was thought to be on December 25th.
Oh, interesting.
Christians are talking about that date even before, though, that date shows up in the Roman sources. So, yeah, it's
okay.
It's
so we have two different Roman kind of events that people sometimes associate Christmas with: Saturnalia, which you said was December 17th, and then Sol Invictus.
That's right.
On December 25th, but the second was not being talked about by the time that Christians had established the date of Christmas?
That's correct. So the idea of Sol Invictus having his birthday on December 25th is not instituted until the Emperor Aurelian on the year 274.
Okay.
And so you already have Tertullian, the Christian writer, in around the year 200, talking about December 25th as Christ's birthday.
Yeah.
So for Christians, the date of Christ's birth is only sort of secondary for their importance. His death is what's of ultimate importance. And so again, it's Tertullian who's our first source to tell us that they dated that as March 25th.
Okay.
And the reason that's important is because when you calculate March 25th as the day he died, then it's very common in the ancient world to think of key dates as having a cyclical aspect to them. So a lot of famous heroes are born and die on the same date.
Oh, interesting.
And so even in like Jewish sources, like the Babylonian Talmud would talk about how the creation of the world and the Day of Judgment will both be in the month of Nisan, which Passover is the 14th of Nisan.
Okay.
So the idea that these dates, all important things happen on the same date. If you calculate Jesus's death at March 25th, then his, not birth, but his coming into the world, his incarnation, must have also happened on March 25th.
Huh.
So the incarnation, or the Immaculate Conception of Christ in Mary's womb, happens on March 25th. Well, 9 months later, that's December 25th.
Okay, interesting. So that's the earliest, is Tertullian the earliest one we have talking about dating Christmas?
He is the earliest talking about December 25th.
Okay.
So there's another contemporary source, Clement of Alexandria, mm-hmm. who talks about others, he doesn't agree with this date, who just date it to January 6th. And then we have other Greek fathers. It seems to be common in the Greek East that some Christians thought January 6th was actually the date of Jesus' birth. And so the best we can understand, that is calculated the exact same way, that there was a debate as to when Jesus' death occurred because it's around Passover. Mm-hmm. And there is a controversy called the Quartodeciman controversy in the early church. Polycarp is a sponsor of this. And the idea is that if Jesus died after Passover, which is also always the 14th of Nisan on the Jewish lunar calendar, then you celebrate the death of his death and resurrection on that date, whether or not it falls on a Sunday.
Okay.
Other Christians said, no, we have to celebrate Easter on a Sunday because that's the day of the week that matters. So if you then go with the Greek calendar trying to follow the 14th day of that month, you end up with April 6th, whether it's a Sunday or not, being the date on which Jesus died.
Got it.
Again, that must be the date he was incarnate, April 6th. Fast forward 9 months, you get to January 6th.
Okay.
So back to the idea of Saturnalia. Saturnalia is this winter solstice celebration, right?
Okay.
So that's why there's a lot of pagan holidays around this. So ironically, Christian celebration of Jesus' birth is tied to that sort of solar calendar, but only because Passover, on the day in which Jesus was allegedly born and died,
right,
is a harvest festival. So it's in the spring equinox. So oddly enough, these things are all tied together, but by no surprise, it's because the ancient world lived and died by the lunar calendar, the harvest festivals, things like that.
Yeah, interesting. Well, thank you for that. Okay, and you also have told me that you'd like to tell us about Saint Nick.
Yeah, so Santa Claus.
Give us the story of Saint Nick.
Okay, so Santa Claus is named after Saint Nicholas of Myra. He was a real person.
You might say Saint Nicholas.
Yes, there you go. Exactly. So that's where the name comes from. The character is very, very different. So it's a long story I won't go into, but the question of who was the original Saint Nick or Saint Nicholas is we don't have all the details we would like, but we know he was at the Council of Nicaea, which is 325.
Okay, an important council.
Very important council where Christ's full divinity is affirmed. So when Nicholas is listed there in the number, the names of bishops who attended. He's actually not in the earliest list, and that's a little disappointing, but most historians still think it's reliable enough. It's as reliable of information as we could have.
Interesting.
And you have it corroborated by the fact that there are accounts of a church that was built by the Emperor Theodosius II. So he's around the year 400. He built a church to honor St. Nicholas, and his bones were housed therein.
Okay.
And that's pretty, that's like, that can be verified. Like, his bones were still there at the First Crusade when Venetian traders came and stole the bones to kind of protect them. And so now they're in Venice, and you can still go visit them and see them.
Oh, fascinating.
So, St. Nick is not at the North Pole. He's in Venice right now, at least his bones. And
which might be preferable, I don't know.
Yeah. So it's a long story as to how he comes to be something like what we think of as Santa Claus. For our sort of popular cultural expression of who Santa Claus is, my understanding is it largely comes through the Dutch Sinterklaas, who sort of completely revamps this Saint Nicholas into someone who wore red all the time and who gave gifts and helped children. And that is based on a account of Saint Nicholas's life. He gave away all his money. He especially helped one predominant family who had lost their money and had three daughters, and so their daughters would not have a dowry to be married, so he would sneak in their house at night and leave bags of gold. So the original Saint Nick had something like this gift-giving and this caring for others, especially the young. But our idea of Santa Claus is a lot of other sort of cultural content got put in there with him.
Interesting. I don't know if you'll know this off of the top of your head. Is Saint Nicholas a patron saint of anything?
Yes, he's a patron saint of many things, actually, of sailors because of some miracles where he allegedly helped sailors who were in a storm. I think also children and traveling in general.
Okay.
There's several others. I can't even remember them all.
Cool. The real Saint Nick.
There you go.
Well, great. Thank you so much for joining us, David Wilhite on Currents and Religion.
Happy to help. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to David Wilhite for some holly jolly history. And now, we're going to hear from Allison Brown, a fourth-year PhD student in Baylor's Religion Department. She studies the history of Christianity and is going to tell the story of how singing carols became a Christmas tradition. Allison, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. A carol is a really beloved tradition in Christianity, and carols are beloved today, but they're the ones we sing now. Some of them have ancient origins, some have medieval origins. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about the very first carol and then how they became controversial in the Reformation. So
Amazing. One
of the first ones is a Latin hymn written by Bishop Ambrose of Milan in the 4th century, and it's Come Redeemer of the Nations in the English translation. And it's a lot about Jesus, of course, the birth of Christ, but it's about the meditation on the incarnation, the virgin birth, includes a lot of Christocentric reflections from the Old Testament. And one scholar even calls it basically a catechesis of the Nicene Creed. So it's a lot about how to teach congregants about the divinity of Christ in a time where that was a controversial question in church, in theology, and doctrine. So it talks about consubstantiality of the Son with the Father. And so these carols not only became part of worship, but a part of polemics and catechesis. So how you teach and defend the faith. And also celebration of the birth of Christ. And so the feast of Christmas and all that entails, including Advent, the 12 days of Christmas, Epiphany, became more settled in the medieval era. And of course, the songs developed around that. Some of the songs sung in church were a lot about the Old Testament, some prophecies they saw as fulfilled in Christ. So like, O Root of Jesse, O Key of David, O Radiant Dawn, these are kind of antiphons, these short texts that were sung. Also, they added Christmas themes to existing songs, so just kind of adapted the liturgy.
Oh, interesting.
But some songs were, of course, not Christian or church songs. They became kind of feasting festival songs, and those became a little bit more issue later with the Puritans, which I will talk about in a minute. But one of the most famous kind of medieval songs that came from the medieval era and then popularized in the 16th century is the Coventry Carol. So you guys, it's on, I think, a Point of Grace album that I listened to in my youth a lot, but it's the Luli Lule, That Little Tiny Child. So that originally comes from one of the Coventry plays, and it's actually a reflection on the Massacre of the Innocents. Oh. So when Herod kills the children, this song was meant to be sung by the mothers who were lulling their babies to sleep so they wouldn't cry and be found by the soldiers. So it's this really kind of tragic, sad carol, haunting melody, if you've heard it. But that was really popularized in the 14 and 1500s. So that's a famous one. And then in the Reformation era, so the 16th century, England loves Christmas carols. We have talks about Henry VIII, and at court, they're singing carols. And the first printing of Christmas carols we know is from 1521, and by Wynkyn de Worde, who's one of my favorite printers' names ever.
Yeah, no kidding.
Wynkyn de Worde. And there's only one page existing. It's in the Bodleian Library, but it has a Boar's Head Carol, which has Latin and English in it. So it's kind of like a fun ditty about celebrating with a boar's head, which may be an ancient like Norse tradition. Anyway, it's not one that you would probably be familiar with. No,
it is not, but also, I am familiar with boar's head cheese, which you could enjoy at Christmas time, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. La nice charcuterie. We love it. And a carol of hunting as well, which is kind of this really funny, nonsensical, well, to us modern people, nonsensical about hunting. And so again, these are not necessarily church songs. So again, they became very popular. You can have Christmas songs that are not necessarily Christian or spiritual in that way. But one of the greatest lovers of Christmas was Martin Luther. He wrote at least 5 carols that we know of. And the most famous is From Heaven Above to Earth I Come. And so this was based on Luke 2, the kind of the famous narrative of the Nativity, and was written for a Christmas pageant for children. And he talks a lot about the incarnation, just like we saw in the earliest Ambrose hymns, a lot about the incarnation, of course, Christ's birth. And it has like the angel talking to the children and the children responding. And so I have a few little lines that I really liked. There's the angel is singing from heaven above to earth I come to bear good news to every home. This is the English translation, obviously. Mm-hmm. This is in German. So not Latin, again, so it's in German. So for the people to sing in their native language.
Right.
And then we have about God's humility. So God coming in the form of a baby for velvet soft and silken stuff. You have but hay and stray rough. And so it's really, the last verse is really beautiful because it talks about making it very personal, which is for Luther, of how does God enter in and how does suffering, Christ's suffering, redeem humanity? And so it says, my heart for very joy now leaps, my voice no longer silence keeps. I too must sing with joyful tongue the sweetest ancient cradle song. And then he goes to glory to God in the highest, from the angel's pronunciation to the shepherds. Mm. So it's this really lovely hymn. And he wrote a few more to shepherds as they watched by night. So for Lutherans in the Lutheran tradition, Christmas was welcomed and celebrated. But it became an issue with more on the Reformed Puritan side later in the 16th century. So the Scottish Church in 1560 banned what they called, quote, abominations not in scripture. So it wasn't just Christmas. It was any feast day, anything that had kind of a whiff of Catholicism. Huh. They were really concerned about. They were concerned that not only was it not scriptural, but it led to kind of carousing and unholy feasting and festivities, which there were a lot of really that feasting and carousing and kind of these inverted carnival-esque celebrations. So where like the proud became weak and the weak became proud, and like a bishop of a boy was always kind of nominated as a bishop, and it was crazy. And so they're really worried about those two things. And so from and then that kind of leaked over also into the Puritan Commonwealth. So when Oliver Cromwell took over in the 1600s in England, the feast and the nativity was banned. So Christmas was banned. William Bradford, and so in the Puritan Massachusetts, Christmas was banned from 1659 to 1681. December 25th was just a work day like anything else. So with that, all the songs and the traditions were tamped down. But then in like Virginia, so a Church of England colony, so not a Puritan colony, they totally celebrated with songs and carols. And then, of course, in Spanish Florida, so in St. Augustine, they celebrated Midnight Mass and sang their traditional songs there as well. So we have, and of course, that those traditions have changed over the years. Different songs came in, and it's different in every region. Bohemia and, you know, what is now the Czech Republic, they loved Christmas carols during the Reformation. So it just really depended on the region, how they interpreted certain parts of scripture and how they celebrated the fifth year.
Interesting. Allison Brown, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Allison, for historically validating that the best way to spread Christmas cheer is singing loud for all to hear. Now, we're going to hear from David Krishna, a third-year PhD student in Baylor's Religion Department. David is going to share a little bit about how Christmas has been received around the world in more recent times, from countries in Africa to Indonesia to the Middle East. Thanks for joining us, David.
Thank you, Zen, for inviting me here. For many of us, Christmas is, understood as a celebration of the birth of Jesus and a time for family gathering. Mm-hmm. But in the history of old Christianity, which is my field of study, Christmas has been associated with different meanings. This time, I will highlight only 2 points.
Okay.
The first is Christmas associations with colonialism and Western domination, which, we don't think about it. we don't associate Christmas with colonialism. But so this might be surprising to some of us, but in some places in the world, Christmas was once considered as an extension of colonialism and Western dominations.
Right.
So now I have one example. For example, in 1974, Mobutu Sese Seko banned the celebration of Christmas in his country. He was then a president of Zaire, which is now known as the Republic of Congo.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so Mobutu, who was raised and educated in Catholic school, and I think his mother was Catholic as well, he saw that Christmas and even Catholic and Protestant churches in his country as a form of colonialism and Western dominations of Congo.
Sure.
Who present in Congo. He believed that in order for Zaire to be free from Western influence and control, the people of that country must throw off everything related with Western culture and religions, including stopping celebrating Christmas in December and replacing it with the national celebrations that took place in June. But that's interesting that he saw Christmas is not just celebration, religious, but it represents Western colonialism in that country. But the opposite happened in East African countries, many of which are directly adjacent to Congo. So they close near to each other.
Right.
From the 1930s to 1970s, in the history of what Christianity, it is known as the East African Revival.
Oh, okay.
During that revival, many people are African native become Christians and they become a member of Anglican Church. So the number of Anglican adherents in those countries, in African East African countries, which is Uganda, Tanzania, and other countries as well, the number of Anglican adherents in those countries increased so much that today the Anglican Church has a strong presence there. Interestingly, at Christmas celebration in East Africa today, many churches, many Christians sing Western Christmas song and carols in which some of the lyrics mention about snow,
right,
and freezing air.
Yes.
Even though December to February are the hottest months in the regions. Yeah. So it just like, it that doesn't connect. You know, like
right,
the song is about snow, but actually in the hottest moments.
Right. Yeah, contextually, it doesn't register.
Yes. Yeah. It doesn't fit actually. Yeah. Yeah. So when a researcher asked about this to the native Christian there, they replied that these songs were taught by Western missionaries who introduced Christianity in their regions. Apparently, for the native Christians in East Africa, they do not regard Western Christian hymns and carols with snow and freezing mm-hmm. air as a domination of Western culture in the African context. But rather, they see it as a spiritual heritage that they inherited and they cherish from the missionaries. By singing Western hymns and carols, they feel connected to the larger body of Christians beyond their own context. So therefore, from these two cases, from Congo and also in East Africa countries, for some, Christmas celebrations is associated with Western colonialism. But for others, it is associated with spiritual heritage and ecumenical relations. So for some, it is kind of dominated. So it's mm-hmm. a dominating power, like imposed to them, you know, like upon them. But for others, it's free. It makes them related to the broader world of Christians, you know, like connect
right.
them to outside Christian, outside African context.
So yeah. do you have any kind of hypothesis or is it just kind of clear about
yeah.
why there would be such a kind of split in the associations that these various regions make?
Right.
Is it a political kind of development?
Yes.
Can you say a little bit more about why you think that they do perceive
yeah,
it so differently?
So in terms of scholar on, you know, like a student of world Christianity, you know, especially if we study Christianity in Africa, there's difference between in Congo and the East African, even though they are neighbor, you know, mm-hmm. like each other.
Of course.
And in Congo, in Zaire, in Christianity there, they have, how to say, oppositions. They feel, some Christian there feel that the Catholic and the Protestant church there becomes help the colonial government
mm-hmm.
to rule, to take control of the country. One example for that is in Congo, it's very known, there's an indigenous African initiative church there called as the Kimbanguis. Mm-hmm. So Kimbangu there with at the time, he introduced Christianity as something that more related to native.
Okay.
He was to They receive the Christian's message, but they say that Christianity that they know from the missionaries is too Western. And they try to contextualize, they want to understand it and express it in more traditional, native way to their people. Mm-hmm. But then there's for the Western missionaries at the time, they thought that Kimbangu is considered as syncretic, it's not Christians. So they dispel him, like you're not part of Christian.
Right.
So he just built and start his own church. So so for Mobutu Sese Seko at the time, he thought that the same way. He thought that Christians, Western Christian, has become a threat, but the native indigenous Christianity, which is the Kimbanguis, mm-hmm. becomes of the, this is the expressions okay. of native Christianity. And the opposite is happens in the Western, so the East African countries. Mm-hmm. At the time, there's a figure, Apollo Kifebulaya. He became the one who introduced Christianity, the Anglican versions, Anglican Christianity into the Eastern African, and it is well received by the people.
Okay.
They don't feel it is something that's strange. So he can even incorporate Western Christianity and introduce into the native context, and people just receive it. You know, like there's no resistance to it. So they incorporate Western type, you know, like Christian missions, Anglican with those high liturgy, part of their religious identity now. So there's a, when we talk about in terms of world Christianity, when a Christianity comes to a certain regions, we cannot see that Christians only as a single or monolithic entity.
Right.
Christianity that came to a country may be different, and the way that people on the ground, you know, like people, mm-hmm. Native people respond to it can be so various, you know, like very different.
Right.
So how Christianity spread, how Christianity interpreted in certain area is depends on that interrelations mm-hmm. when the message was introduced to that context. So that also happens in terms of Christmas. Why people like have different understanding of Christmas? Because again, the meanings, it's like lay on the interactions between the transmitter, mm-hmm. which is the missionaries, and who people and the native people who perceive it, understand it, and put it into their own context.
Right. Interesting. And so you also have something that you want to talk to us about related to interreligious kinds
Correct.
Of expressions of Christmas.
Yes. So, for the second point, this is the second point. So my second point is Christmas associations with interreligious relations. And for this point, I will use an example from Indonesia, my home country.
Yes.
In December 2015, a small radical Muslim organization in Indonesia swept shopping centers and banned Muslims from using Christmas attributes and costumes such as Santa hats. You know, like, we don't think even like, why should a Muslim like you ban swept and ban that Christmas Santa hats, you know. But according to them, Christmas attributes and decorations and costumes in public spaces can distort the faith of Muslim.
Okay.
For these small groups, they mm-hmm. thought that way. Of course, the majority of Muslim Indonesia reject that behavior, you know, like, but still
just for my context, in Indonesia, is there a dominant religion?
Yes. So 80%, even like almost 85% population of Indonesia are Muslims.
Okay. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So, but, you know, like the majority of Muslim Indonesia reject that behavior, reject that idea, but still some small Muslim support the actions. Mm-hmm. And that support make the sweeping occurred for 2 or 3 years in a row, like mm-hmm. year by year, every December.
Yeah.
Before the organization was banned and declared as illegal by Indonesian government.
Okay.
What is interesting about this case is that the organization considered Christmas ornaments and costumes such as Santa hats and even Christmas tree mm-hmm. As an object that has religious meaning. in public, you know, like,
right.
Which, well, most of Christian, even in Indonesia, they don't associate Santa hats as something related to Christmas per se, you know, like,
At least to the story of Jesus, right?
Yeah. But it has no religious meaning. Mm-hmm. But for some Muslims, they associate it
right.
with Santa hats as to Christianity, and so that's why it has a religious meaning mm-hmm. into it.
Mm-hmm.
So for them, for some small radical Muslim in Indonesia at the time, the Santa hat was a covert form of Christianization perpetrated by Christians to convert Muslims to Christianity. But on the contrary, I want to bring us to another context. On the contrary, in several Islamic countries in the Middle East and North Africa, Christmas is celebrated together by Muslim and Christians.
Hmm.
I have one example. So, for example, it's the celebration of Christmas in Bethlehem. The majority of Bethlehem populations today are Muslims.
Okay.
But because the city is the birthplace of Jesus, every year many tourists come to the city at Christmas time to celebrate Christmas, you know, in that city. But the tourists are not only Christians. Many of them are also Palestinian Muslims from the surrounding cities. Muslims participate in Christmas because they see Christmas as a celebration for both Palestinian Muslims and Christians. Because when they come to and celebrate, they take part of a Christmas celebration, they see Christmas as more how to honor Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Well, because there's Jesus as well, story of Jesus in Muslim tradition as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they respect Jesus as one of their prophets.
Right.
So for them, it is just to pay tribute, you know, to pay respect to one of the Islamic prophets as well.
Mm-hmm.
So for them, Christmas is not something that divide them. It becomes some avenue to celebrate unity, to celebrate similarities, to celebrate together as Palestinians, because they want to celebrate the Christmas. The Muslim Palestinians, they want to celebrate it with Christian Palestinians there. So I think from these two examples, both in Indonesia and in Palestine, we can see that for some, the celebrations of Christmas in public can be considered as a form of hidden Christianization, which may challenge the harmony of interfaith relations. But in contrast, for others, Christmas becomes a venue for interfaith celebrations. So it just different contexts will interpret Christmas differently. And I think it's, again, if we compare to African contexts, well, some of them like perceive Christmas as like extensions of colonialism. Here in Muslim context, it's the way why people have a different understanding or the way they have different meanings of Christmas because they have different stories,
right.
Because they different history related to Christmas as well. For people in the Middle East, Bethlehem is part of the when we celebrate as the birthplace of Jesus, but for Muslim is part of the Muslim land as well. After
right.
they, you know, take over like during the Islamic Caliphate at the time. So for them, it is not something that should be divide them. It is just we can celebrate together. It's more like cultural heritage. It's
right.
more traditions that we should, you know, like keep together among them. Yeah.
David, thank you so much for sharing with us a few ways that Christmas is received in a global context.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks again to David Wilhite, to Allison Brown, and to David Krishna for contributing to this episode, for offering us glimpses of Christmas throughout history and around the world. And thank you, dear listeners, for letting us be a small part of your Christmas season. From all of us in the Baylor Religion Department and at Baylor University Press, we wish you a very happy holiday season. Until next week, take care.